You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coves. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere on God's magnificent planet, Miss Ellen.
That's right. On 1510wwbc.com, you can hit that website and go to the Listen Live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. Of course, the On Demand button just means that you go to the show selection. You just pick Mondays at 1 o'clock. We're here on each and every Monday here Eastern Standard Time that you can tune in. And then, of course, we share it on all of our social medias and all of our websites, which is SitaMediaInc.com. And then, of course, on the social media platforms, it's under Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And another fantastic show we have today, Sita, with great people.
That's right. So for our listeners who are tuning in today, our show today is we've got three great guests. We've got Mr. Arthur Rubin, who's calling in, I think from New York, is it? Mm-hmm. Arthur Rubin is calling in, as well as Eleanor Cooney, and they are the co-authors of a wonderful, amazing book called Ivy Hill. It's a novel inspired by true events that actually happened in Arthur Rubin's life. And I have to say, I read the whole book, the entire thing, in 24 hours. Not sitting at one time, of course, right, over a period of 3 days. Now, that'll be our first segment. Our second segment is with our friend Tara Gibson. And as everybody knows, Tara's mom was on our show and introduced Tara to us. She's also a good friend of our friend Stanley. And she's going to be speaking about the All Black Foundation, and that Tara is a sports and business professional with over 15 years of experience in the industry, and she'll tell us all about volunteering, why she has this nonprofit, who supports her mental health, physical health, emotional health, everything that we need to make our community wholesome. And so we'll talk to Tara in the second segment. Tara, thank you for being here on our show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Right. And in studio, we've got my co-host, Ellen O'Neill, who's been with the show for 15 years. We couldn't do today's show, any other show, without Ellen. She suddenly rigged our phones today.
Oh, no, Tara came in with the clutch.
That's right. And Allie Tamber is here. Allie is fills in for Ellen at times, and she stays with us in the studio. She's what we call our resident intern forever, right?
That's it.
Then Danny's running our board.
I learn something
new
every day.
So our show, Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, is fun. It's unscripted, it's very educational, and we give out valuable information to our listeners or anyone who wants to learn how to write a book, how to sell a book, how to save money, how to spend money, how to buy a home, what should you look for if you're voting for a candidate. Do you want clean water and sunshine, environmental advocates, people who come here to fight for domestic violence victims? We talk about bullying in our schools. We talk about our teaching profession. We speak about physicians and COVID and whatever is going on. So our show, we give everyone a platform to come and sit here in the studio on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, or call in like Art and Eleanor is doing this morning and speak with us. And without further ado, Miss Ellen, I think I'm going to go right to the phone because the bios are very good. They're quite extensive, but I think I'll have our guests start up and talk to us a little bit about this wonderful book called Ivy Hill. So, Art, I am going to talk to you first. Yes. Because I think I'm very blessed that I was able to connect with you through social media, and that you are supporting Viewpoint with Sita and Friends by sponsoring this segment. So talk to me a little bit about yourself. I know you went to American University. I know you went to a wonderful high school, and And I want to know all about you and what transpired that make you write this book. Go for it.
Well, I could give you the long version or the short version. I guess.
Think the short. Yeah.
I was a almost retired certified financial planner when I started on this, which was 9 years ago. And at that time, I'd been married 34 years, and my wife had heard a lot of stories about my stepfather, and she knew him a little bit, mostly just as a creep, but not a whole lot else historically. And the more I had told her over the years, coupled with my reducing workload, she said, why don't you just start writing some of this stuff down? And I said, no, I'm not gonna do that. And she said, no, really, just, you know, do 15 minutes a day, a half hour a day, just whatever you remember. So I bought a bunch of legal pads and started doing it. And eventually I had a 140-page manuscript on legal paper, and that appeared to be at least the basis of what I hoped would be a TV pilot. I never thought I would write a book, and I then spent 4 years trying to sell a TV pilot with no contacts in the industry. I didn't know any producers. I didn't know any big-name stars. I didn't have an agent, and I just started sending out this manuscript and realized that you can't do it like that. So I eventually gave up. I asked my son, who was in the business, if he could help me find an editor and try the book route. And through a friend of a friend, I wound up getting introduced to Eleanor, even though we've actually never met, and spent the next 4.5 years writing this book, which is now an Amazon bestseller known as Ivy Hill.
And bestseller so it is, and I can tell you why, because you make your characters come alive. I felt like I was witnessing what was happening in that book, and I wanted to wring Oren's neck. I tell you, I never think about things like that, but that's one man that I said, oh, I want to give him a good left hook. But anyways, so let's go to Eleanor. Eleanor, so you guys have never met. So how did you end up conspiring to write this book together?
Well, we did it all via email, and we spoke on the phone only a couple of times. But we had rapport, and we hit it off so well, so quickly, that the thing really took off with its own momentum. And it was remarkably smooth sailing, considering the amount of work we did. But, yeah, we've never met face-to-face. We probably will someday. But
maybe you guys could come to Florida.
That's right. Yeah, she makes a mean curry chicken.
Yes.
now you're talking. Now you're talking.
So Ivy Hill, it's an unforgettable journey, from what I read. And Art, talk to us a little bit. We don't want to give away the whole book, but the book has like a very broad nostalgic appeal to America, because it's set in a time when, you know, it was supposed to be a happy time for most people. We didn't have a lot of wars. Mm-hmm. People were able to still rock and roll. Men were and women and,
right.
and were work, men were working, taking care of their families. The teenagers were trying to roll up a joint behind their parents' back.
Mm-hmm. Not me.
You know, they were you were smoking something called Pall Mall, which I never heard of in my entire life.
Pall Malls? You never heard
I never
of Pall
heard,
Malls?
I never heard of it. And I'm like, I'm going to have to ask him. So talk to us a little bit about the setting for this book, the nostalgic appeal.
Well, the nostalgic appeal is more of a coincidence or background music. It just so happened that a lot of what was going on in Eddie's family was also going on in the country. The rock and roll piece that you mentioned was only a part of it. We also had, you know, the assassination of Martin Luther King and JFK and Bobby Kennedy. We had the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of bad stuff going on, just like there was a lot of bad stuff going on in Eddie's house. You know, the Woodstock concert was in 1969, and Eddie was a junior in high school, practically gone by then. But, you know,
on the Manson murders.
Well, yeah, absolutely. People my age, who, you know, the baby boomer generation, Eleanor's age, you know, grew up with very fond memories of the 60s, but also we had race riots in many cities. I mean, there was a lot of bad stuff going on.
Yeah,
also,
the reader gets the feeling that, like, everything we've seen on Time Magazine and People Magazine over the last three decades is kind of sort of in this book. And I think Ellen is kind of glancing at the cover right now, and she's got a question.
Yeah, and I'm from Jersey City, so like the places and the information. Yeah, the information that you're sharing here is, I remember, like, I grew up in the 60s in Jersey City, so I know exactly the tone of what this is. And because of the book, you've attracted quite a diverse audience, right? And it's really, it seems like around a lot of these movies that were filmed in and around New Jersey, Jersey City, like Manhattan, all of those areas. Give us some ideas of what people can expect when they look at, when they read the book, about that, about the connection with all of those types of crime.
Well,
and
yeah,
cool
they talk
mob
about
stuff.
The Sopranos, The Wire, Philip Roth, the New Jersey Shore, the Jersey Boys, Breaking Bad, and in our time, or my daughter when she was in high school, Snooki.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so talk to us a little bit about that. Eleanor, you could take that one, or maybe Art. It doesn't matter at this point.
Well, just as context for people who don't know what Ivy Hill is, Ivy Hill is a neighborhood in the far western corner of Newark, New Jersey.
That's right.
if you just see the title, you think it's a British novel, but it's, you know, it's far from it.
Well, and and to your point, Ivy Hill, that we had a Society Hill as well in Jersey City, and that's where when they knocked down Roosevelt Stadium, they had put that community there, and that community became much like a neighborhood, sort of like a Melrose Place, but around like the Jersey Boys type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember that.
Okay, go ahead, Allie.
Allie. Can you catch me over here? Okay, it's I was going to ask that several of the features of the book create sort of a universal appeal, and it's kind of good versus evil, and or a David versus Goliath, you know, both of which both of which Eddie's got to overcome. So you've put us on the edge of our seat, trying to figure out how Eddie's going to overcome all this.
There's a principle. There's a principle in psychology, which applies to typically father-son type relationships that don't go well, and it's called identification with the aggressor. And Eleanor's brought this into play in several instances throughout the book, although she probably wasn't aware of the psychological terminology for it. There are a number of instances where Eddie hears something that someone says to Erwin, or takes something that Erwin did to him and does it or says it to another kid. Sometimes it's bullying, sometimes it's name calling, but it's never good. And the reason traumatized children do that is to try to master an opponent that can't be mastered, or a way to deal with a threat that otherwise they have no idea how to deal with, so they wind up copying them. And it becomes sort of a pathological behavior pattern that doesn't lead to good things happening for the child, but it's an adaptation to an abusive situation.
Right.
And
it goes back. It goes back to what we all say, right? The foundation for everything starts in the home. And Eddie certainly,
absolutely.
Yes, and Eddie certainly was in a terrible situation after his father died, having to live with his stepfather. So Eleanor, you know, the characters in this book are flawlessly crafted. And they come alive with each page that you turn, that character is coming alive. Talk to us a little bit about Oren's gambling problem, child abuse, bullying, all these things come to play. And also, Oren almost had a lack of remorse. He felt like he could do anything he wanted without any kind of consequence. So talk to me a little bit about Oren and that character that was crafted so well.
Yeah, well, thank you. It so happens that I had a wicked stepfather too in my real life. He wasn't quite as bad as Oren, but he was pretty bad. And similarly, I have an older brother, and my stepfather bullied and humiliated my brother, but treated me like a little princess. And so I drew on that. I mean, this is how novels get written. You draw on authentic truths from far and wide in your own life or in other lives that you've observed, and you use them to craft the personality and character of the fictional character that you're working on. So, yeah, there was a real Oren, but I didn't have to meet him. I mean, you know.
Yes.
Art's descriptions of him were rich and deep and full of information. But I drew heavily on the meanness of my own bad stepfather and added that to Oren. So gave him a sort of an extra dimension, I think. And we're often inside Irwin's head where he justifies his bad behavior. He does that a lot. And he often feels like the victim. He feels as if everybody's mistreating him and nobody appreciates him. And then he'll quickly shift gears to his next perfidy. You know, he'll steal money from Eddie and gamble it away and justify it in his mind and then punish Eddie if he loses a game. I mean,
yeah.
The most primitive psychology.
Well, Mr. Arthur Rubin, so Eddie's journey from childhood to adulthood it's heart-wrenching, mm-hmm. It's inspiring. He faces so much adversity, but at the same time, he was able to combine humor and be funny and cope with what was going on in his home. Was that you growing up? Did you do all of that to cope with what was happening at home with Edwin?
Absolutely. I realized early on that I could sort of figure things out very quickly. I've been told that I'm an empath and a highly sensitive person. You mentioned that I have a degree from American University. I actually have two. And I also have a third degree, which is a master's in social work from Catholic University. And I found that program to be so easy that I wound up being unable to stay in that profession because I would solve things too quickly and my supervisors could never see how I got there. So it became very frustrating very quickly. And by age 29, I had left and went into financial planning, where I stayed for the next 40 years using the same skill set that I probably was born with, but certainly had cultivated, you know, through my early 20s and graduate school. But I always knew where that pressure point of this is too dangerous was and to not quite like go past it. But I also had way too many close calls for a kid to have, including a summer job in Newark's housing projects between high school and college, which I never should have taken, but I did. And
it changed your life.
It did change my life in more ways than one. I did survive the experience, had a very, very close call. But also met somebody who is introduced very early in the book who helped me figure out something that I didn't see.
Right. And who's, whose idea was it, Eleanor, for the chapters to be, they were short and sweet? Because the reader feels like, oh, I'm finished with this chapter. I'm in the next one, next one. It just kept flowing and flowing. And me as a reader, it is a gripping tale. I also fell in love with Eddie's grandma, Bess. And I thought everybody...
Wasn't she great? Yeah.
Yes, and I feel like everyone should have a grandmother like this. But I had misgivings when it came to Sam. I was like, he's not... I don't understand his way of thinking. I understand it was for that time period, but what a mismatch him and Bess were.
But there was a 10-year age difference between them, and it was another one of these marriages that probably wouldn't have happened today because they were so different. And she was, in many ways, subservient to him, but then behind his back, she'd give you a look. Like she knew he was full of shit, she would never really take him on. But she figured out Erwin very quickly. And one day, many, many years later, when, you know, we were all adults and all that kind of thing, she turned to Erwin and said, "I know what you want."
So yeah.
That was pretty ballsy of her for a 4'10" older woman to
a boobala.
Look up at a 6'6",
it sounds
six,
just
whatever.
Like my mom.
Yeah, it's a boobala, right? So here's the thing. So for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today, we're speaking with two authors of the book Ivy Hill. It's a novel inspired by true events of the life of Arthur Rubin, and Ellen was able to rig a phone so we could have both of them on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today, calling in from New York. But in the book, there are so many scenes that are familiar to so many children. You know, I know a lot of kids, and I'm Indian, so I felt like I was in a Hindi film at some point, too, with all these characters. Bad guy, good guy, you know, grandma, loving family, whatever. Yeah. And then I read the part about the bar mitzvah, and I knew it. I knew he was going to take those checks. And in my bed, I'm looking around for an envelope to put those checks in and save it out of my mattress. Why was Marcy so complacent with that? Why was she letting her husband run the show when she worked so hard on that? To me, I'm the kind of woman that would take that envelope, put it under my arm, and keep those checks and cash safe with me for my son. But it's almost like she was under power and control of her husband, and she could not do anything for her two children without him just watching and a look, a feel, a touch. I don't feel like Marcy lived up to being a mom, especially that day of the bar mitzvah. Am I being too judgmental?
Not at all. But quite frankly, she was 34 when my father died, when Sid died. She had two young children. And she, quite frankly, never recovered from that loss. I think she may have had a psychotic break. At a minimum, she was clinically depressed for the rest of her life. She never sought help, either for herself or for Eddie. And she was as stubborn as her father was. And she just sort of buried her head in the sand. She never wrote a check. She never looked at the finances. When Erwin would drive somewhere and the guy was practically blind, if we ever got a driver's license, she would just take out her knitting and not look at the road.
Yeah, she was in a trance. I think she was kind of like in a trance.
Yeah, totally.
Just going with the flow.
And when Eddie was a teenager, he used to say, "I'm going to the Jersey Shore for the weekend," and just walk out of the house. I mean, there was no parental control. There was no supervision. Basically, you have a kid raising himself in the presence of two college-educated so-called parents. And, you know, fortunately, the kid got through it, but you know, there were a lot of hard lessons learned along the way.
Right. So Eleanor, you made a comment earlier about when he took the summer job. So realistically, Edwin thought he would actually sue the city if something happened to Eddie. He was looking out for himself for money to pay all his gambling debts. He was such a crook.
Yeah.
He was such a crook. So here's the thing. Working in the summer in that job, taking care of those apartments with Bobby J. Lewis, Bobby J. turned out to be the turning point, actually, that saved Eddie's life. Let's talk with 3 more minutes or 4 more minutes. I'm going to give you guys a few more minutes extra. So quickly, let's talk about Bobby J. and his impact on the life of Eddie.
Bobby J. was an amazing guy and a real tragedy. In that he was never able to get out of Newark. I had seen several other sensational high school athletes who got into similar issues and wound up jeopardizing their college career and maybe even a shot at the pros. I had heard that Bobby J was like a once in a decade level, you know, football player. He did have a full scholarship to the University of Alabama, wound up having a couple of kids in high school, got into dealing drugs to pay for them, got arrested, spent some time in jail, and, you know, lost everything. But he was exceptionally bright, exceptionally funny, cynical, probably had a very, very high IQ, and was sort of a legend in the city. And here he is working in a housing project, supervising, you know, a little crew of people who clean out apartments. And
smelly,
you know,
apartments.
Summer help.
Smelly apartments, dirty apartments, apartments that really are not even fit for people the way they describe some of them. Your book addresses racism. Your book addresses the inequality of wealth. Mm-hmm. The book addresses generational poverty. It's an emotional and gripping story. And it also shows you the differences, even though the skin color issue comes up quite a lot. And it shows the reader that sometime if we don't listen to history, we're doomed to repeat it. Because you see that happening in today's world, in not just in the United States, but all over the world. How were you, two of you, able to entwine all of that into this book? A little bit of every single thing is in this book. Eleanor, you take that question.
Well, the story just has such integrity to begin with, the setting, the characters. It was unavoidable that we would address all of those issues. And it's important to point out that Bobby J., you know, they often talk about playing in that in Hollywood and in books and movies, there's a white savior. I would say Bobby J. is the black savior because he's the one who cuts through Eddie's naivete at a crucial point and tells him what Irwin is trying to do to him by sending him to work at this horrendously difficult job. And Eddie overcomes it. He aces the job. But it's Bobby J. who cuts through the white boy naivete of Eddie in a very crucial way. I think Bobby J. is just a hero.
He sure
He's
is.
Such a great character.
So, Mr. Rubin, were you able to ever confront Irwin in real life and say, hey, look what you did to my college application. What a weasel, what he did with that check. It was just horrible. And then he did that to you. Then he took your hard-earned money from working in the projects, too. And he also took your bar mitzvah money.
The money from the projects he didn't get his hands on because I was old enough to put that in my own account. And he couldn't get that. And I did use that first semester at school and wound up getting a job right away working in the cafeteria.
But
did
you had some money
American.
You had some money that you had saved up. Was it from the gigs with the music that he knew you had?
The money from my band was spending money through high school. the money I earned during the summer from working at the projects, again, that was not available to him because I was 18 and I was able to open my own account.
Thank God.
So, yeah, that was, and then of course my grandmother helped out getting me in for the first year. But I worked steadily through college. Then my two graduate degrees, I got scholarships, one of them even a stipend for living expenses. So that worked out really well.
Well, I would like for you to give our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends the website or where they can buy this book, Ivy Hill. It is such a story about love and death and danger and bullying, and everything is in this book, racism. And I even got from it why people should even vote, because when you think about who's living in the projects and who is controlling that part of the city, you want to know why there wasn't better a government as well, you know? So tell us where you can find this book, and give us, each of you, if you could give us a 30-second spiel as to why someone should buy this book. Go first, Eleanor, before we sign off this segment.
Okay, well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also read our fantastic readers' reviews. We have just some excellent, wonderful reviews. And, you know, anywhere you can buy books online, Thrift Books, Goodreads. No, they don't sell, but Goodreads. Yeah,
Barnes & Noble.
Right, exactly. And I would like to just add, I think the salient thing about this book is that Eddie, even though he was abused by his 6'6" stepfather, he decided, he made a conscious choice to not be like Irwin. Too often, abused children imitate their abusers, but the rare ones change their minds and say, no, I am not. They turn away from it consciously. They make a conscious decision to not be like the abuser. And that's what Eddie/Art did.
Yes. And Art, I'll give you the last few seconds. Your book is it's timeless. It's a universal tale. It's about redemption, morality, conquering so much adversity that you face. And I just want to say, you're my hero, you and your sister and your mom. And
well, thank you.
For going through all of this and coming out of it and giving so much back to the United States and changing your life. And you also were talking to your high school friends and you found out that they also had a lot of issues growing up as well. And I think you used, you know, you had so much challenges that you used it to make yourself a better person and people around you. So give us the last 30 seconds of why someone should buy this book, read this book, and also who do you think should play your character in a movie?
Well, first of all, I'd like to, in addition to going on Amazon.com to look for the book, that you take a look at our Facebook page, Ivy Hill Book, where we have posts, where we have comments. We've got a couple of reels. One or two of them have music. We do have a soundtrack for Ivy Hill, which we just took some songs from the 60s that we thought fit with the tone from the book and put them on our Facebook page. As for the book itself, certainly any baby boomer should read this book just for the nostalgia. It has a lot of really great feel-good moments and chapters in it that'll bring you back to your teenage years, your early 20s. And also, stories about New Jersey in general tend to be very popular. The Sopranos, Jersey Shore, you know.
Well, and anytime Jersey people meet each other, we always ask what exit, right? So we have this, like, connection.
Yeah, Boardwalk Empire, which is about Atlantic City. The shows tend to be very popular. And we're certainly hopeful that one day we'll all be able to watch Ivy Hill on television, which was its original purpose.
And all the folks that all the folks we have listening, it's amazing how many contacts that CETA has. We'll make sure we share this on all of our information as well as our social media and our website. And you'd be surprised as to how many people connect with CETA over things like this. So we hope the same for you both, that Ivy Hill becomes some series on Netflix or some place that we can all watch it and remember when you were on the Viewpoint with CETA and Friends show. So unfortunately, we are out of time, and we are going to take a quick station break to listen to our sponsors. Art and Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about Ivy Hill. And folks, we will be right back right after these messages with Viewpoint with CETA and Friends.
Cloud Nine Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer.
Lizette's Cajun Bistro is the place to be. They offer Cajun and Creole staples as well as American, vegan, and vegetarian options. The restaurant is located at 2447 North Wickham Road, Unit 146. All menu items are prepared daily from scratch and made to order. Dine-in or takeout as well as outside seating. Live music on selected weekends. So the next time you have a taste for Louisiana, stop by Lizette's Cajun Bistro, 2447 North Wickham Road.
Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads. 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000. Or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is CETA McGee on Viewpoint with CETA and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere.
That's right. All over the World Wide Web.
Even New York, New Jersey.
Even New York, New Jersey. AM 1510 WWBC.com. You can hit that listen live button. And you get us live on any one of your streaming devices. And then, of course, you can always hit the on-demand button. You'll be able to pick by date. Look under Viewpoint with CETA and Friends. Of course, we're here each and every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we had a great first segment with some Jersey folks. As my brother calls them, Jersey Americans. That's what we are.
Right. And our second segment is going to be just as fast-paced and moving with our friend Tara Gibson. Tara is a sports and business professional with over 15 years of experience in the industry, and she's here to speak with us about the All Black Foundation and all the awesome events they're having to give assistance in our community so that she can make an impact. And so thank you for coming on.
Yes, thank you for having me. I am always excited to talk about and share what we have going on. So, again, thank you all for having me.
Yeah, and I saw you nodding your head when the gentleman was talking about the foundation for Everything Starts in the Home.
Yes.
And also when he talked about, even though you're born into certain circumstances, you don't have to stay in that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that kind of aligns with kind of the work that we're doing, mm-hmm. because a lot of people are coming in to these communities, and there's work already being done. And so our approach is we don't want to be like everybody else. So we're taking the approach where we want to work from the inside out, because it starts at home. Period. And so you have to make sure the home is healthy. And if the home is healthy, the people coming out of the home will be better. And then they'll also want to take advantage of all the resources that are being made available to them to help them live healthier lives.
Yeah. So, Tara, how did you get involved with the All Black Foundation? Because you were doing other things before.
Yeah, I was. And so it's like an accumulation of my life work. So as you can see, you know, I have a background in athletics and sports. I've coached, I've played. And I've mentored. I've been an academic advisor at the colleges. And so this is just an accumulation of my life's work, and we just put it in a foundation. And I actually started it with two of my students that I've mentored. They've grown and matured now, and so we came together to kind of extend our brand reach, if you would say, to help now mentor communities.
Right, yeah, I know. It's just awesome. Sports, right? Sports is so important. When you keep people's minds busy, because I notice at the gym even now at LA Fitness, there's so many kids in the evening that come in with their basketball in hand, and it's a whole crew. And then outside in the parking lot, they'll talk to each other and high five and bro this and bro that, and they're talking, and I'm like, this is so nice because they're making a connection, right?
Yeah, and the thing about it is I've noticed, you know, obviously, you know, being African-American, but before, you know, when we had the movements of the civil rights and stuff like that, the church was the place.
The meeting place.
Yes.
Right.
But that's changing. It's changing with this new generation. It's changing. So sports and entertainment drive our culture right now. You can see it says, you know, art imitates life. And so a lot of times you see what's happening in our communities is based upon sports and entertainment. And so what we decided to do and take this route, and because it's my passion and I feel like it's my purpose, we're using that sports and entertainment as the carrot to bring people in, to draw them to us. And when we have them, we pour into them with the other relevant stuff to help people live healthier lives, like the educational piece. And we call it edutainment, because we're entertaining them, but at the same time, we're educating them. And hopefully they can, you know, take that information and make better decisions.
Right. And Allie, I'll let you jump in here, because what she said makes a lot, you know, she's speaking about arts and entertainment making such an impact. Of course, we all remember reading about Woodstock. I wasn't there. That made an impact in culture, too. But you've seen that as well.
Oh, absolutely. What we do with our friends and the play that happens, you know, is these the interactions. Then we make actionable movements around based on, say, what our parents might be doing or how they respond. So they're learning whether that's a good response or not. And we're going back to the books that the guy had earlier, you know, Ruben was here, that it's you learn from the group you're around. And if you can find people that attract you because you're similar, then you're more respectful of them and can learn where you need to learn.
And Ellen, that goes back to when, you know, our parents would say to us, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are.
Exactly.
Isn't that the truth, Tara?
Yeah.
Even up to today.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think, like, and part of what we do when we're talking about bringing people together, it does. Like, sports bring people together. Entertainment brings people together. And it brings them together in a lighthearted way where they can put their guards down. They can put their biases down and get to understand and know people for not for the color of their skin, but for who they are, their character, and things of that sort. So we that's why we really love what we do, because it's fun. And plus, we love seeing and bringing people together, because we think when you understand the different cultures, not that you have to accept everything, but you can be able to relate to people and give people grace where it's needed.
Yeah, well, you get both sides of things too. You know, you learn from everybody, right?
And I remember in the city, like as a kid too, we used to play stickball, and we played stickball behind the projects, and it was one of those types of neighborhoods. My two best friends were Chico and Julio. They were two Puerto Rican great Puerto Rican family. But we even had kids that had Down syndrome that would come join us. And like everybody, so like in my circle of friends and my circle in the city, color wasn't even like a factor, but also disabilities weren't a factor. And we got to appreciate everybody. And you get to do that through sports.
And music. And that's
and music as well.
Music
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely. Exactly. It didn't matter what anybody was. Everybody was.
That's right. Music always brings people together as well. So, Tara, why should people get involved in their community? Why should people get involved in community outreach?
Yeah, and I think it's important, because we hear so many people, like, say they want to get out the hood. You always hear that. I want to get out. We're trying to get out the hood. And my thing is this, like, it's important for people to be able to grow up around their culture. It, you know, and although we are a blended nation, it's still okay for you to grow up around your culture. And I feel like people need to go back to make our hoods, quote unquote, for lack of a better word, healthier. And so if you have all the people that are doing well and making better choices like Mr. Rubin did, choosing to break those generational trauma that happens and start generational healing, those people need to come back and give so that we can so it can be a domino effect.
There,
because a lot of the people that are causing the issues and the unsafe living conditions are people that we know, and you speak their language, and you can come back and encourage them, hey, there's a better way, let me teach you, let me show you, rather than a stranger coming in that you don't know trying to teach you something that you're probably put up a wall against and receiving that. So we just feel it's so important for people, especially if you get educated, you graduate college, or you spend some time in corporate America, to bring that back to your community and help the people that are still there to level up and live a healthier life.
Yeah, and you know, you hit the nail on the head. When people get an education or they leave the neighborhood, that's a void.
Yes.
That needs to be filled.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else is going to fill that void.
Right.
It might not be somebody you approve of.
Exactly.
It might be worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
And, you know, we know that every year in our country, there's over $200 billion given out in grants, donations that are distributed by corporations and government organizations towards charitable education and philanthropic missions. What can we do? What can we do as a community to help the All Black Foundation? There's so much grants out there and things out there to help people like you who are trying to change the neighborhood from inside out.
Yeah, and thank you. That's a really great question, because it's hard. I mean, and the biggest thing you have a lot of people say, even with small businesses, is funding, right? And so us being a small team, we need people to volunteer their time and help. Help us write the grants, help us position ourselves financially, because they ask for financial statements. But when you're operating on a low budget as well, because, you know, I fund a lot of this stuff out of my own money sometimes just to see things go. So having that someone to come in, sit with us, go through our financial records, teach us how to position ourselves to get these grants, teach us how to write a grant. There are people that are out there that can do this stuff. We just need you guys to come back and be willing to help us do it. And that's kind of what we do. Like, we don't know everything, but we've helped so many other nonprofits get started just based upon sharing what we learn, what we know. And that's all it is take people coming back, spending the time to help those that are trying to do better, to help empower us, educate us, and show us the way. Because if you show us the way, we'll do it. And once you educate us, then we can educate others. And
right.
That's the thing.
Right. And the education doesn't have to always be because somebody has an alcohol problem or a drug problem or an addiction from the education could be, how do I maintain my loan?
Yes.
The education can be, how do I fix my sprinkler system?
Yes.
The education could be, teach me how to paint.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you teach, like, what is that? When you teach a man to how to fish,
right?
Yep.
Then he can fish for life or whatever,
you give him a skill. Right? You give a man a fish, you feed him for a day.
Right.
You teach a man a fish, you feed him for life.
Right.
And
so
that's
what
we want.
Right.
To
so what you're saying is, if you live in the neighborhood and you get an education, it doesn't mean you have to leave.
Right.
Show the neighbors.
Yes.
How do we water the lawn? How do
mm-hmm.
we plant flowers? How do
yes.
we plant a kitchen garden?
Increase property value.
Right. And mm-hmm. right, because then the sidewalk has a break in it.
Right.
Who do we call?
Right.
Well, that's where voting comes in handy.
Mm-hmm.
Your city council member.
Showing
so
up to the meetings.
Right.
You know, people
exactly.
need to go to. That's where you get changed. Like, if you don't go to those city commission meetings or those school board meetings, nothing is going to. Just your. People think because they don't have the money, they don't have the impact.
So revitalize your own neighborhoods by using your smart, you know, right?
Yes.
And your voice.
And your voice.
Exactly.
So what would you say to people who are listening to our show today and say, well, I just can't live in a neighborhood because of the streets, the neighborhood, the sidewalk. There are no good businesses coming in. There are no jobs. Maybe there's gun violence. Maybe there's police presence all the time. The schools are not a school. What do you say to them? Because we want all zip codes to be appreciated, right?
Yeah.
Not just certain ones.
Yeah, and that's understandable because I don't even live in a hood either, for lack of a better word, right? So I think you don't have to live there. You have to have a starting point, right? You just can't go dive in. Some people can. But go back. You know, go spend time there, right? Like I said, you know, go start the process of developing and uplifting the neighborhood so that we can move back and feel safely doing so. So if you really want to get something done, you can start by that way. Just making small steps, getting together, and making the steps to beautify the community, make it safer, encouraging people to get out, be present at these meetings, to vote, to own it, you know, encouraging people to do that. And I think if people would do that, it will help start the process where we can have a neighborhood where people will want to move back into and feel safe in doing so and raising their kids. Because I understand why people move, but it's never going to get better until we own it and start making changes within
our
community.
If everybody decides to move, then what becomes of the neighborhood?
Exactly.
Then the people that you were fighting against, they stay.
Right.
And they own the turf.
Yeah. Well, and some of the success stories in urban, you know, urban ghettos, if you will, right, is that they start a community garden where everybody participates. And then it builds that, you know, fellowship. If they're not going to church, much like what Tara was saying, that you know, that foundation is not always in the neighborhood church anymore, where it used to be. Mm-hmm. So now we need to find new ways, a basketball court, a community garden, you know, a pickleball court. I mean, well, I don't know what's popular now that people would have, you know, neighborhood
just
concerts.
Just good old-fashioned sit down and have a talk.
Exactly.
Speak with the elders in the community.
And I was just going to say,
the elders
when I was
in the community have so much knowledge and experience to teach the young ones. And I think oftentimes it's that we have to listen to the people who've been there before, the voices of the experience. And Tara, I want to bring back your attention to, like, you see a lot of kids and people in with the All Black Foundation mm-hmm. with problems at work, problems at school, absenteeism from school, truancy. There's a lot of people who have no motivation, no energy. They're spending excessive amount of money on other people's Starbucks, no pun intended, right? But they don't know how to save a dollar. So you are bringing in people with the All Black Foundation to help folks like that,
yeah.
To teach. So tell us about some of the people who've made it in life and have come back to give to the All Black Foundation.
Yeah, and so like when you talk about that, it's like the young men that I've mentored that came together with me to create the foundation, right? And so doing things like that, mentoring my students and then having them come back to give. And like I said, there's so many ways that people can help. They can support small organizations like that, like us, by donating to our organization, by telling their corporate companies that, hey, we believe in this organization. We want our corporate company to back us and donate to our company and become a corporate sponsor for us. So there's a lot of ways that people can help and give back. And it's really important because I think people are so not motivated because sometimes you can get caught in pacifying poverty. Like, so many people come to give back, and so that's what makes us different. People come, like, they come back and give turkeys and toys during the holidays. To me, that's pacifying poverty, because as you guys know,
I can't stand that sometimes, because yeah, you yeah. give them the turkey and yeah. the toys, and it's the same people yes. showing up every single yeah. year. Well, what about teaching them a different thing?
Exactly.
Like, break asking for the turkey,
yes.
right? And yeah. how do you stop that? Education.
So, and that's it. And I think, like, it's nothing wrong with giving back, but our thing is add an educational piece with it, so you can help uplift them and pour inside of them so that next year they are volunteering to help someone else.
To give
else.
The turkey
exactly.
out instead, right?
Instead of receiving it.
Well, there's a goodwill, right? There's goodwill in everything mm-hmm. we do, right? Mm-hmm. And you do a lot of that. So with the All Black Foundation, it's not just black people. It just says All Black Foundation, but you have other people, other races, other folks involved as well.
I am so glad you brought that up because it's so frustrating because I'm like, when people throw shade on our name, I'm like, really? Like, why? Because do you not go to the Carrabba's Italian restaurant because it's Italian?
That's right.
Do you not go to Kobe's Japanese restaurant? Or
China, Taste of India.
Or,
you go to Taste of India.
Exactly.
There's not no Indian people
exactly.
in there.
Or China Walk. Do you not go to these spaces or you think it's only for those people? And so I think because people lead with their biases when it comes to black, and we want to change that narrative. Anytime you see people see anything black, it's negative to them. They think, oh, you know, they get defensive with us. And like, that's why we named it that, because we knew after that 2020 Black Lives Matter thing, once it died down, we knew it was, you know, it's no longer trendy. So no one's talking about it. We wanted to have our name so people, we can show people you're leading with your biases, because for you to think that all we want to do is help black people and we don't want to help anybody else, that's your biases leading. You need to check that. Because if you go to our website, if you come to our events, if you have a conversation with me or anybody on our team, you would know it's bigger than that. And we know that we have to have allies, regardless of color, white, brown, whatever. We need allies because we're only 10% of the population.
Well, that's what it called. You need
we're only 10% of the population.
Well, they say you need other people's money to help you,
yes.
right? In order to, because you need money, time, influence,
yes.
a reach, and a platform. Mm-hmm. And you have the platform, So now you need other people's money to help you to get the word out.
Exactly.
So give us the website and how someone could contact you if they wanted to, because it's remarkable what you're doing.
Thank you.
It's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a lot of hard work, and you won't believe the resistance that we get, but we're still pushing forward because we've seen the impact, and we get the stories and we get the testimonies. So it's really a beautiful thing. You guys can follow us on all social media platforms at All Black BOTG. That's IG, Facebook. You can follow us there. And we also have our website at www.allblackab.com. That's www.allblackab.com.
Well, you are trustworthy, and you're credible, and you have a lot of goodwill in the marketplace. So I think the next step would be for you to try to reach out to other people in our community. There's so many people trying to cash in on the African-American community. And a minority base, but are they trustworthy, right? So there's so many people that's doing that. So you partner with other people as well.
Yeah, we have to. I'm like I said, if you're gonna have any impact, regardless, I tell my students all the time, even on their academic journey, like you have to ask for help. You cannot do it by yourself, and we know that we can't do it by ourselves. So there's a lot of great other organizations, like you mentioned earlier, Stanley Briz, Brevard Venture Coalition. He's
now they
guy.
Have like a Black Chamber of Commerce too.
Yeah, they do have that as well. But Parrish Medical Center has been, they have been amazing in sponsoring us and keeping up with us. I know some people feel some type of way about Parrish, but listen, they are out in the community, and they are always having our backs and what we're doing to help bring positive change.
And you have Truist as well, right?
Yeah, Truist, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Juliana at Truist. They're amazing. I bank with them, and then they also, help support us as well. So we have a lot of good corporate people that are helping us. We met with Coca-Cola earlier this year.
So events, quickly before we go off air, because you're helping people mentally, socially, physically with their health
as well,
and financially as well. But you have some events coming up.
Yeah.
So tell us about the events coming up, and so we could at least do PSAs for you and tell our friends and family about it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So we have some local events, and we are international. I mean, we're going to be international, but we're national. But we do have an event coming up here in Titusville with pro basketball player Romeo Crouch. He has a camp. Shout out to the YMCA. They have offered to let us use their facility for the camp. And so we'll be having a camp there. You can go to our website to find more out about it. There is a fee for the camp, but if a child wants to come and they can't afford to come, we will scholarship that child. So please do reach out to us. A lot of times our events are free, but for this particular event, it is a charge. So people need help about that. So it's raising everyone's confidence. Romeo does a great job of pouring back. He's from here, and he does a great job of pouring back into the youth in the community. And then we have two other camps coming up. One will be in Deltona, Florida, which another pro basketball player, Chad Brown. And then our finale will be in Savannah, Georgia, and that's the Health and Hygiene Expo that we're doing. It's something different, never really been done before, but we're going to talk about health and hygiene amongst male football players.
Oh, that's awesome. And how long is the camp, the basketball camp?
So the one camp we're having here in Titusville is going to be it's two sessions. First session is May 30th and 31st, and the second session is June 6th and 7th.
And how much is it for this segment?
Per session is $100 per session.
For 2 days?
2 days.
That's not bad at all.
Yes, 2 days. Yep.
So we'll pledge on Viewpoint with Cedar and Friends. We'll support one child.
Okay. Awesome.
We'll
Thank
give
y'all.
You that
Appreciate
to support.
That.
Because,
yeah,
this is what we need in our community, right? Because it's not about us. It's about helping everybody else. Thank you for doing the community outreach that you do and reaching so many people and helping the kids. Kids have mental issues, emotional issues. Yeah. They've got problems at school. And if we can give back to them, why not?
And I have many more contacts for you, so we'll talk
you
off air.
Sing.
That's right. We'll do a whole lot of stuff, I'm sure. But thanks again, Tara, for being here and sharing the airwaves with us and telling us all about the All Black, the community involvement, the community engagement that you're doing. It's fantastic. Sita, fantastic job again of getting great guests. Make sure you check out Ivy Hill on Amazon.com. And, of course, each and every Monday here on 1510 WWBC. You want to tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And, folks, we'll see you next week.